We're back. Yeah. Phil was explaining to me about nuclear weapons, if you caught a bit of that. It's
yeah, well, I was saying that Canada was part of the Gang of Nine on the vote on Palestinian statehood, but the next day the gang had shrunk by one-third. The Czech Republic, Panama, and Palau couldn't do it again. So that now Canada's part of the Gang of Six.
Czech wasn't not big enough. Well, anyway. Bad pun, wasn't it? I didn't even know that I'd done that. Okay, well, I just want to say that I want sports to pull themselves together. In the boxing match the other night, I don't know what in terms of who won, who didn't win. I mean, it was all on the up and up. But there's something really crummy going on. When a key witness from the Balco scandal, the biggest performance-enhancing drug scandal involving Olympian, American Olympians, Marion Jones, and the runner Tim Montgomery, they both went to jail because they were, as a result of the investigations and criminal outcome, you know, of that, was involved the man who's the power trainer for Mr. Marquez. And he was hired by Mr. Marquez under the name Hernandez. And they said, well, didn't you tell him that you were, your real name is Heredia? And he said, well, I did, you know, it wasn't important. So everybody says, well, okay, Marquez went on the up and up. I don't, maybe he did. But you know something? Why did he hire this character? I said that Tim Montgomery and Marion Jones went to prison. This guy sent them because they were his customers. He turned them in. He didn't go to prison. They went to prison. He's the one who sold them the drugs. And I should say he also told them how to use them. So he's in the corner of one of the fighters the other night. And I read the Globe and Mail, and they don't tell me that. But that's go and look it up. A very ugly figure from the Balco drug scandal was in the corner for Manny, what's his name? Juan Manuel Marquez. And I'm not saying that Marquez was using. What I'm saying is he hired a guy who was a crook, and a serious one. And when he found out that he had a different name and had been involved in Balco, he didn't fire him. He says he's great. He's a wonderful trainer. So anyway, that shows me that boxing is just as bad as it was when I was a kid. So at least we have a tradition. We are joined now by Zafar Bengash. Are you there, Zafar?
Hello, Phil. Yes, I am.
Hey, thank you very much, Zafar. There is a bunch of things we need to ask you about.
Okay.
I think the biggest one maybe is a matter of Gaza.
Yes.
And this a lot of activity. We spoke to you 3 or 4 weeks ago when we asked about this matter. The emir came there, the emir of Qatar.
Right.
Now, the emir is deeply involved in arming and training and even providing personnel and cooperating with Washington and others to destroy the government of Syria.
Yes.
Now, he visits Gaza.
Right.
Now, last week, the King of Jordan went to visit the West Bank.
Yes.
None of these guys are well known for their desire to liberate the Palestinians.
yes.
And this leads to speculation about the political leadership of Hamas.
Right.
And I see two arguments. One group says, well, Hamas is already surrendering. They're going to go along with some kind of deal cooked up between the Egyptians and others and the Palestinian Authority. But then there are other people saying, no, watch them closely. They're not actually committing. That they are talking to everybody, but they haven't committed one way or the other. But they're right in the center of the whole thing.
Yes.
Can you make an assessment? What is going on there?
Yes. Well, first of all, since the Israeli onslaught that was launched on November the 14th and lasted until November 21st, and the fact that Hamas was able to withstand this onslaught and in the process also lob a few rockets at cities like Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, etc., at least in the eyes of the Palestinian people, it has increased Hamas's prestige immensely.
Mm-hmm.
That's one aspect of it. At the same time, what we witnessed was that for the first time, officials from a number of countries, Egypt, Tunisia, Tur- Turkey, many foreign ministers from the Arab League countries visited Gaza while the Israeli onslaught was underway. What it meant was that Hamas has now gained in stature on the international stage. Mm-hmm. Even the Americans and the Israelis were forced to deal with them, although, of course, indirectly. But when Egypt was working out the ceasefire agreement, it was a really funny situation that in one room, Israeli and American officials were sitting in the Egyptian foreign ministry, and in a room beside it were Hamas representatives sitting, and mm-hmm. the poor Egyptians were running between the two rooms, sort of carrying messages back and forth, taking proposals from one to the other.
A nice allegory there.
Yes. So, and what emerged out of those discussions was that Hamas actually was able to prevail in the conditions that it had set out for the ceasefire agreement. Hamas's conditions were, number one, that Israel should stop attacking. Number three, mm-hmm. it should stop carrying out targeted assassinations of Hamas political or military leaders. And number three, Israel must ease the blockade of Gaza. Israel's condition was that Hamas must stop firing rockets at Israel. And number two, that it must stop other groups from doing so as well. Now, Hamas had always indicated, and it said that we had agreed to precisely this even before you launched this war. And in fact, an agreement had been reached on November the 14th, which was brokered by Egypt, that there would be a ceasefire, that Hamas would stop firing rockets and Israel would stop attacking Gaza. And yet it was Israel that violated that that agreement by killing Hamas's security chief, Ahmed Jabri. So ultimately, when the ceasefire came into effect, it was Hamas's terms that were accepted. And that's why we saw that immediately after the ceasefire, there were celebrations in Gaza, but there were no celebrations in Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. In fact, an Israeli survey carried out had indicated that only 20% of the Israelis felt that Israel had won, mm-hmm. and 28% of Israelis said that Hamas had won. Mm-hmm. So this is interesting to find that for the first time, Israelis themselves are admitting that Hamas had come out on top. Mm-hmm. Now, to come to your question as to whether Hamas is willing to negotiate or is it compromising, etc., I would say that we need to look at exactly what Hamas has said. They have said that they are prepared to accept the 1967 borders because they said that's a ground reality. Mm-hmm. That's what they have said. But they said that every inch of that territory that is sort of marked by the 1967 borders, Israel has to vacate. So that's their position that they have officially stated. Mm-hmm. And these other, as you mentioned, King Abdullah of Jordan visiting Ramallah, and mm-hmm. earlier on, the Qatari king who had been to Gaza, etc. These are people that are basically emissaries on behalf of the United States. And they also, of course, have relations with Israel. But I believe that now the ground reality is changing in the sense that now Hamas is not isolated, that new forces that have emerged in the region, they are going to be more sympathetic to Hamas and the plight of the Palestinian people. And Israel would not be able to carry out its policies the way it has done in the past. True, Israel has, of course, immense killing capacity. It will continue to do so. But now it will also, there are two sort of reflections of that. Number one, that Hamas would also be able to retaliate against Israeli attacks. And I think they will, as time goes by, they'll become more and more sophisticated. And number two, politically, Israel is now completely isolated as opposed to Hamas being isolated. Mm-hmm. And I would suggest that what is currently happening in Egypt – previously it was happening in Syria, but now in Egypt as well, is the direct consequence of Israel and its allies inside Egypt, and of course American agents operating inside Egypt. These are Egyptians that were always aligned with the U.S. and Israel. They are now hitting back, basically to destabilize Egypt so that it would not offer too much help or support to Hamas in Gaza. I think we need to look at the situation in Egypt in this broader context.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, whatever has been going on in Egypt, I mean, it's so incredible when I look at the details. The people that are, these opposition figures, Amr Moussa, al-Baradei, and others that are screaming for democracy, they are doing precisely the opposite of what democracy requires. What is more democratic than participating in a referendum to determine whether the constitution the people would accept or not? And yet they want to frustrate that, they want to postpone that, they want to undermine that. And in fact, even their representatives who were in the constituent assembly that was charged with drafting the constitution, these opposition groups, their representatives were given positions in all of the five drafting committees. They were not excluded from any committee. And when there were certain contentious articles, there were two, Article number 2 and Article 219, and there were these two articles were contentious, and the opposition groups had objected to them. And when finally it was agreed by all groups that, okay, we will refer it to other legal experts, let them formulate the wording of that, then in late October, when the legal experts drafted those two articles and presented to the Constituent Assembly, every member, including the opposition members, accepted those and actually signed on to them.
Mm-hmm.
And even after they signed on to those articles accepting them, then in early November, they decided that they were going to boycott this, and instead they would rather have the courts dismiss this assembly, either dismiss it or it will run out of its time by November the 12th. And so by December the 12th, so this assembly would no longer be able to present a constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the kinds of games that were being played in Egypt with respect to this constitution making. And the excuses that they made was that, well, Morsi has taken over dictatorial powers. But what they ignore is that when the courts dismissed an elected parliament at the end of May or beginning of June of this year, these same people did not complain about this. They said nothing.
Mm-hmm.
They had, for the first time in Egypt's history, there was a parliament that was elected freely by the will of the people. And yet when the courts, in which the judges, of course, are the ones that were appointed by Mubarak, and they are part of this deep state in Egypt,
mm-hmm.
when they dismissed this parliament, not one of these opposition members complained. They actually celebrated the dismissal of a legitimately, freely elected parliament of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they wanted exactly the same thing to be done to the Constituent Assembly, to have it dismissed so that there would be no constitution, and Egypt would continue to be in a state of limbo. And they are hoping, the opposition, of course, is hoping that they can create so much chaos that the military would ultimately be forced to come back and grab power, so that then it would be back to the same old situation that was before.
This is Zafa Ben-Gaish, crescent-online.net. Zafar, following on that point, I get the impression that it's kind of like almost revolutionary conditions in the history of revolutions, where power seems to be bouncing around and hasn't settled.
That's correct. Yes.
I mean, for example, I guess I'd be curious to know, Egypt is such an important part of any issue, any resolution of issues in the Middle East.
Yes.
There was questions about the leadership And I wonder, how did all the various leaders react to the Gaza attack, for example? I mean, a lot of people said, well, aren't they going to open that border? Or how are they going to handle that? And is there anything they could do?
Yes, that's a very good question.
To assert themselves as Egypt.
Yes, you know? Exactly. That's a very, very good question. number one, as far as the President Morsi is concerned, of course, he and his government expressed open sympathy for the people of Gaza, and he sent his prime minister as well to Gaza. But obviously, the people of Gaza need more than symbolic gestures. There is a body of opinion in Egypt that says that if the Egyptians were to open the Rafah crossing, then so many Palestinians would leave Gaza that they would become a problem for Egypt, because Egypt itself is not going through a very good period of economic situation. In fact, since the uprising last year, the Egyptian economy has been battered badly. So this is one body of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I personally hold the view that if President Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, if they are sincere, I don't think that they should allow such considerations to come in the way. The people of Gaza need help, mm-hmm. and they should provide all the help that they can provide to them. Mm-hmm. We know that they need approximately 1,000 to 1,200 trucks of goods every day into Gaza to merely survive. Now, that's food and other items of necessity. Israel, until recently, had been allowing only 100 trucks per day. Mm-hmm. That means only less than what you call less than 10% of their needs were being met. And therefore, naturally, the misery index of the people of Gaza was going up. The Egyptian government can, and I believe they must, open that border crossing and allow the free flow of goods into Gaza, and in fact also allow stuff to be brought out of Gaza, not merely people mm-hmm. that are wounded or people that need medical attention, but the Gazans also produce a little bit of fruit or whatever. If they were able to sell it in the Egyptian market, then they could buy something with it and take it in mm-hmm. back into Gaza. Mm-hmm. I think that is the thing that ought to be done. But regrettably, it has not been done so far. And we have to admit that the government of President Morsi has failed on this count. I don't expect anything from the other opposition leaders, whatever. They are only interested in trying to undermine the government in Egypt, and they are involved in all kinds of disruptive tactics in order to frustrate the political process, in order to prevent the approval of the constitution, mm-hmm. which naturally would call for fresh elections to parliament within 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And they are afraid that if elections were held, then naturally they would lose.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not something that they look forward to. So they think that their best bet is to create as much chaos as they can.
And delay.
Yeah.
This is Zafar Benkesh. The site is crescent-online.net. And now there's a matter that is involving us all, this decision for the Germans and the Dutch to provide the Patriot missile. I don't know what's a Patriot of what country, but anyhow, a Patriot missile to the Syrian border for Turkish side with consequences which everybody is knowing that it would indicate a desire to create a safe zone, maybe even a spot where a toehold can be established for the so-called Free Syrian forces and all that. With the increase, I wanted to put a tag on that, this question. There's two parts to it. There's that phenomenon is happening. At the same time, over the weekend, we were inundated with a bunch of stories about how, well, the rebels are winning or gaining, and the Russians are wavering. And proof of that they were wavering was that they had a meeting with Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And then it turned out, well, it wasn't just Hillary and Lavrov, but it was also Mr. Ibrahimi.
Yes.
And they said, well, you see, we are winning, the rebels are winning, and Russia's backing off. But then Mr. Ibrahimi said, well, we did meet, and we said, you have to go by the Geneva Agreement.
Correct.
Which means no demand for the removal of a head of state, because
yes,
that's improper.
Correct.
Yeah, could you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. You know, this is the kind of thing, when I read the stories first, you know, of course, Hillary Clinton was sort of blowing hot and cold, as she usually does, demanding that, you know...
She's married to Bill, that explains.
She said that we want a political solution to the crisis in Syria. These were her words. And then she said that, but in any political solution, Bashar al-Assad has to go. I mean, you know, and then she even... so, you know...
Our political solution is our political
solution. That's correct, exactly. And then she said that, you know, we have had discussions with the Russians, et cetera, and we feel that there should be a political solution and all parties in Syria should be involved in it. These were, you know, this mm-hmm. is something that Hillary Clinton said. When I read the statement from the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, he said that we exchanged ideas, we met and we discussed, and we have always insisted that there should be a negotiated settlement to the crisis in Syria, and that this is not being helped by arms being smuggled into Syria and given to the rebels, and that... Mm-hmm. When we say that there should be a negotiated settlement, we have never agreed to the removal of Bashar al-Assad. He said that this is not an issue of one individual. It is an issue of a country, and it has to be looked at in that context. Mm-hmm. And then after these two statements, as you mentioned, the statement of Lakhdar Ibrahimi, it came, and he clearly stated that the political process has to move on the basis of the agreement that was reached in Geneva in June of this year. And that was, of course, chaired by Kofi Annan when he still was the head of the UN peace process mission, mm-hmm. that he had agreed in Geneva that all parties would, first of all, there would be a ceasefire, that all the parties would get together to negotiate in good faith. But there was absolutely no mention of the fact that Bashar al-Assad would have to go. So these are things that obviously the Americans keep on talking about. Mm-hmm. And they just want to sort of, you know, try to create the impression that they are the ones that will determine the future of Syria.
Yes.
And you know, the supply of Patriot missiles, as you said, I don't know who's on which side of the patriotism are they on.
Yes.
You know,
it's kind of hard to be a patriot of several countries. You have to make up your mind, is my understanding.
Exactly. And also, at the same time, we see that the Syrian rebels, on the one hand, they make these tall claims, but they then plant these car bombs and all kinds of other... I mean, car bombs are basically acts of terror because they do not discriminate between military personnel as well as civilians. Mm-hmm. And secondly, there are so many of them, and most of them, of course, have flooded into Syria from outside. These are essentially mercenaries. And ironically, while the U.S. says that it is opposed to these kinds of groups that have affiliations or links or maybe directly al-Qaeda type, and yet, as far as Syria is concerned, the U.S. seems to be in bed with these kinds of people.
And yes, we even have people are seeing that these rebels seem to understand that if they could create a crisis over this claim of chemical weapons, that maybe they could get NATO to jump right in.
Yeah.
And they themselves are appearing, showing off chemicals that they intend to use.
Exactly.
And using racist language and religious sectarian language.
Absolutely.
All of these things, everybody says, that's bad, bad, bad.
Yes.
But the leader of that group is Hillary Clinton, isn't she?
Yes, exactly. Like, you know, there was, as you said, there have been first of all, allegations made, and the Americans have been talking this up, that, the Syrian government is now desperate, so they might resort to chemical weapons. There has been absolutely no proof of that. In fact, over the weekend, Robert Fisk was being interviewed by the CBC, and he was being pestered about, but Amnesty International said that Syria had used chemical weapons back in 1981 as well, and Robert Fisk, or actually 1982, beginning of 1982. He categorically denied. He said, I've been to Syria more than 100 times. And he said, I went to Hama, I talked to people. There were absolutely no chemical weapons used at the time. Mm-hmm. And he said, but, didn't the Syrian army perpetrate a massacre? He said, yes, it did. But isn't it funny that the man who was responsible for perpetrating that massacre, Rifat Asad, is now living very comfortably in Mayfair in London? So mm-hmm. why didn't we talk to him and find out what he did, rather than blaming, Bashar al-Assad for that massacre?
Yes, isn't he now hand in glove with the Saudis?
Yes, exactly.
Married to them, I think. He's part of his family.
Yeah. So you see that the man who perpetrated the massacre has been given, very comfortable existence in London, England. And this government, the current government, is being blamed for what happened in Hama. And now this old bogey of chemical weapons is being raised again. We've been through this before. This was, the same thing that was raised in August of 2002 against Saddam Hussein of Iraq, and it was accused, and the New York Times had splashed it on its front pages for several days, when later on, of course, it transpired that all of this information was leaked by Dick Cheney's office and fed to Judith Miller, who basically ran with it, and the rest of the media in the U.S., the one other point that over the weekend we saw videos of these Syrian rebels experimenting with chemical weapons. And these were there was in the background, they showed various crates of chemicals that had clear markings of Turkish companies on them. Their names were printed on those crates, and they showed that they were dropping these this gas into cylinders where there were rabbits, and the rabbits, of course, went into convulsion, two of them, and they died. And then these rebels said, well, this is going to be the fate of the Syrian government and its supporters, etc. And that's the kind of sort of nonsense they were talking about.
Yeah, the criminals. I think they named the Alawi, right?
Exactly. They said that we are going to do this to all the Alawites, which is, of course, they...
And I saw an interview, I think it was Telegraph, London, a British reporter was interviewing Syrian Free Syrian Army prisoners. He made great pains to say it appeared to be him entirely objective. He tested... One of them was a Kurd. He did speak Kurd. He did a lot of this. And they were extremely sectarian people, rather proud of it. They wanted to quit fighting, but they were extremely, they were foreigners, and they were very extreme in their views.
Yes, exactly. I mean, unfortunately, that's the kind of mindset that exists over there, and they're deliberately promoting it. And this is something, this is a signature mark of the Saudis and the Qataris. That's what they want to promote, so that they can hide their own number one, treachery against the Muslims, and number two, that they can play on the sectarian sentiments of people to try to create divisions mm-hmm. and sort of keep on delegitimizing the Syrian government by referring to it as an Alawite government, and therefore not representative of the majority of the Syrian mm-hmm. population. Whereas, in fact, the Syrian people themselves, and even members of the Free Syrian Army, are becoming sick and tired of these sectarian criminals and terrorists that are coming from outside, because they are afraid that their legitimate struggle for their rights is being undermined by these criminal elements that have now flooded Syria.
Clearly has. We need that Geneva Agreement, I think.
Yes.
Zafar, it's very great talking to you. Crescent-online.net. I urge everybody to go to the site. And thanks again. We hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Zafar Bengash. And this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and there's a website, taylor-report.com. And tomorrow you want to catch Phil Conlon at what time?
12 noon, Classical Underground, right here at
CIUT. Classical Underground. There's an important story there. Okay, we'll see you next week.